The Tom Woods Show, episode 1421.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, social media is a pit of misinformation when it comes to the subject of guns. So what you need is my free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Guns. Smashes all the myths and a lot of fun to read. Pick it up at wrongaboutguns.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here by myself today. I want to cover a few constitutional things, and I know some of you folks out there, being Lysander Spoonerites, are saying, well, who cares about the Constitution? Liberty is what matters, and I get that. But on the other hand, I am a historian, and that does carry with it a bit of a curse that I have to investigate questions that in the grand scheme of things, according to my own philosophy, well, maybe don't matter all that much, but I just need to know the freaking answer, and I have to know the answer. And I think it's also a useful illustration, even for ANCAPs, about the way the state behaves. That you come up with this document that's supposed to limit it, and it manages to take a document that's meant to limit it and turn it completely around into something that empowers it. Now, you may say, Woods, no, the Constitution was a coup that was meant to centralize the government, and it was not intended to limit it. Well, that's true. It's true that a lot of people intended that and hoped for that, but the victory after the ratification of the Constitution really went to the decentralists. I mean, it really, yes, obviously the Constitution grants the central government more power than it had had under the Articles of Confederation. Nobody denies that. But by and large, the point is that the interpretation of the Constitution, according to which the Congress does not have plenary power, but has enumerated powers, with the remainder of the powers resting with the states and the people, was victorious by all accounts. Madison, James Madison, had clearly wanted a different system, and yet after the convention was over, he defended the system that was created, that was clearly different, but he defended that system. So what I want to do today is talk about those few clauses in the Constitution whose interpretation has led to all kinds of mischief, and talk about what their obvious original intent was. And it's not difficult to uncover their original intent because there's so much commentary on it. And what made me think to do this episode was I was on Facebook. Yes, I know, mistake number one. But I was scrolling through and somebody had reproduced something on from some lefty Facebook group. And it was something along the lines of Bernie Sanders talking about the need to redistribute wealth. And then the next panel is, I think, Charlie Kirk saying, where in the Constitution does it authorize you to redistribute wealth? And then thinking they're being wise guys, this leftist group then has a third panel quoting the general welfare clause of the Constitution. They say, ah, ha, 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 we sure showed Charlie Kirk. Yeah, because I'm sure Charlie Kirk has never read the general welfare clause of the Constitution. It couldn't be that maybe the general welfare clause is being misinterpreted. We won't even consider that. It's, ha, ha, we showed him. And it just makes me crazy, because it reminds me, for example, of years ago, Bill O'Reilly, remember him formerly on Fox News Channel? Bill O'Reilly saying that federal government involvement in healthcare is justified under the General Welfare Clause. He's supposed to be a conservative, but Bill O'Reilly was pretty non-ideological from what I could see. So we're going to go through these, and we're going to have some fun doing it. I talk about these, by the way, in a couple of my books, Nullification being one of them, and the other one where I maybe get into even more detail on them is 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask. Worst book title ever, but one of my best books for sure. So I'll link to the books at tomwoods.com/1421, and let's start with the old General Welfare Clause. The words general welfare do appear in the preamble to the Constitution, but preambles, as everybody knew at the time, have no legally binding force. They're merely descriptive. So the actual general welfare clause is to be found in Article 1, Section 8, and it says that Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. Now, it's taken for granted by social studies teachers today and by hectoring left liberals that this means that whatever seems to provide for the general welfare is therefore constitutional. Well, obviously, any tyrant who ever lived would say that everything he's doing is for the general welfare. So this would be no restraint on government power at all. And the argument made quite adamantly by, really for his whole career, by James Madison, was that if the General Welfare Clause really did grant the federal government some kind of general power to do anything that it claimed might advance the general welfare, then why did this section of the Constitution then go on to bother listing specific powers the government could exercise? Obviously, if the Constitution had just finished describing a general power to legislate on anything that might advance the general welfare, wouldn't it have been superfluous and absurd even to follow that with a list of specifics? So, I mean, for example, why would you specifically declare that the federal government shall have the power to erect, quote, needful buildings immediately after you just got done saying that it can do anything at all for the general welfare? All right, well, needful buildings would obviously fall under general welfare. Why are you bothering to list it? And that was Madison's argument. He says in Federalist Number 41, for what purpose could the enumeration of particulars be inserted if these and all others were meant to be included in the preceding general power? Then in 1792, he said, and by the way, there are many places I could be quoting Madison from on this. 1792, Madison says, if Congress can employ money indefinitely to the general welfare and are the sole and supreme judges of the general welfare, they may take the care of religion into their own hands. They may appoint teachers in every state, county, and parish and pay them out of the public treasury. They may take into their own hands the education of children, establishing in like manner schools throughout the Union. They may assume the provision for the poor. They may undertake the regulation of all roads other than post roads. In short, everything from the highest object of state legislation down to the most minute object of police would be thrown under the power of Congress. And he portrays this as an obvious absurdity and obviously undesirable, but that's not the way it's viewed today. It's viewed as coming right out of the Constitution and being highly desirable. So then Madison says in 1800, in its fair and consistent meaning, the General Welfare Clause cannot enlarge the enumerated powers vested in Congress. And then in the 1830s, he said, these are his words, it exceeds the possibility of belief, so quote unquote, and then the supporters of limited government should, quote, should have silently permitted the introduction of words or phrases, in a sense rendering fruitless the restrictions and definitions elaborated by them. Then another one of his arguments was, almost immediately after the Philadelphia Convention of 1787 and the constitutions being sent around to the states to be ratified, and right around that time, there were many proposals for amendments coming forth from the states. And these amendments sought to limit the powers granted to Congress under the Constitution. But Madison says, if the General Welfare Clause were really what these expansionists try to pretend it is, just a general grant of power to the federal government to not only decide what the general welfare is, but then just legislate on anything touching on the general welfare, if that really had been contemplated by the General Welfare Clause, he says, then why was there not one single proposed amendment from any state to limit that? He says that is far, far more dangerous than any of the things the states sought to amend in the Constitution. This would have been far more dangerous. There would have been amendment proposals coming from all over the place. But the reason there weren't is that everybody correctly understood that the General Welfare Clause did not mean that. And they knew it couldn't mean that because it was just taken out of the Articles of Confederation, where it obviously did not mean that. He says, it was taken for granted that the terms were harmless because explained and limited, as in the Articles of Confederation, by the enumerated powers which followed them. Jefferson likewise said that if you interpret the words general welfare as granting the federal government, quote, a distinct and independent power to do any act they please, which might be for the good of the Union, this would render all the preceding and subsequent enumerations of power completely useless. And then he said that reading it like this, quote, would reduce the whole instrument to a single phrase, that of instituting a Congress with power to do whatever would be for the good of the United States. And as they would be the sole judges of the good or evil, it would be also a power to do whatever evil they please. Now, to be fair, we might acknowledge that Alexander Hamilton, the country's first Secretary of the Treasury, took a more expansive view of the general welfare clause. There's no doubt about that. But there are some questions surrounding this. For one thing, before New York ratified the Constitution, Hamilton noted in Federalist 17 and Federalist 34 that the clause did not mean that an area like agriculture would come under the purview of the federal government. But once he gave people that assurance, then several years later, after the Constitution was ratified, Hamilton declared that the clause did mean that agriculture could be directed by the federal government. So which one of these opinions are we to take more seriously? The earlier one, that was intended to explain the intent of the Constitution to the people as they were deciding whether or not to ratify it, or the opposite opinion given suddenly and after the people's decision had safely been made? It seems to me the first one is the one that carries the weight, because that's the one being given to people as they are making the decision whether or not to go for this thing. That's when you want to tell them the truth, presumably. And then once they're trapped in there, is it really a surprise that you suddenly spring on them some brand new interpretation? And let's not forget, of course, that Hamilton himself said that he was out of step at the convention. He thought the U.S. should have a president for life. He thought he should have a Senate appointed by the president that served for life. He thought the state governors should be appointed by the president. He thought the British system was the best government in the world, and on and on and on. All right, let's go on to the Commerce Clause. This is the one that really comes up the most when there are hearings for Supreme Court nominees. Everybody wants to know, where does the nominee stand on the Commerce Clause? The Commerce Clause is that part of the Constitution that says that the Congress will have power, quote, to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. Now, obviously, it's the part about regulating commerce among the several states that causes the mischief. It turns out that it's not that difficult to understand what this clause meant either. Commerce, the word commerce, meant only trade or exchange, not, as what we might call its more ambitious interpreters would have it, all gainful activity. Just trade or exchange. There's no reference to commerce at the convention or in the Federalist or at the state ratifying conventions that contemplates any other meaning. Among the several states just meant exactly that, commerce between one state and another, not commerce that might happen to have an effect on one state or another. And then, of course, we have the word regulate. In the 18th century, regulate means to make regular. So that is to cause to function in a regular and orderly manner. And this is in opposition to the modern meaning of the word, which implies micromanagement and control. And it's this sense of causing something to function in a regular and orderly manner that the Second Amendment speaks of, a well-regulated militia. So the purpose of the Commerce Clause is to establish a free trade zone throughout the United States, thereby making commerce regular, and then preventing the states from disrupting this free movement of commerce. And this really is summed up, this idea of the meaning of the Commerce Clause is summed up by James Madison very clearly in this passage, where he says that the phrase, among the several states, grew out of the abuses of the power by the importing states in taxing the non-importing, and was intended as a negative and preventive provision against injustice among the states themselves, rather than as a power to be used for the positive purposes of the general government. Now, as we well know, the Commerce Clause has just gone, they've gone berserk with it since then. The classic case, some of you may even be tired of hearing about, is the old Wickard versus Filburn, 1942. The court rules there, the federal government can regulate how much wheat a farmer grows on his own farm, even if that wheat never leaves the state, so never enters interstate commerce, and the farmer and his livestock consume it themselves. The argument is, had they not consumed that wheat, had they not grown and consumed that wheat, they might have purchased it from another state. And so their abstention from this purchase indirectly affects interstate commerce. Now, that just goes to show the length to which the state will go to justify intervention in the economy. This is obviously an absurd interpretation. So as the 20th century continued, you get from the New Deal on down to the 1990s, there was not a single federal law that was overturned by the Constitution on Commerce Clause grounds until you get to the mid-1990s and U.S. versus Lopez, which had to do with the Gun-Free School Zones Act of 1990, which said you can't carry a firearm into a school zone. Well, 40 states already had legislation like this on the books, so it's not even obvious that it was necessary. But it was a fellow named Alfonso Lopez Jr. who was convicted of violating the act. And his case, in his own defense, was that the federal government had no constitutional authority to enact a law like that. Now, when you look at the federal government's argument in favor of its power to do this, it's just laughable. They're saying that the potential presence of guns in schools might make students nervous. Nervous students aren't likely to get as good of an education because of their nervousness. And if they have inferior educations, they're going to contribute less to the U.S. economy. And if they contribute less to the U.S. economy, that will have a substantial effect on interstate commerce. Therefore, the question of guns in schools could be regulated by the U.S. government. Now, this line of reasoning is actually not significantly more absurd than the Commerce Clause justifications for a variety of other federal laws, but this was just too much even for a normally indulgent Supreme Court. Now, another word on this would come from the book I wrote with Kevin Gutzman called Who Killed the Constitution? In there, we have a chapter on medical marijuana and the famous Gonzalez versus Raich case from 2005, because there the federal government was challenging a California law that legalized marijuana for medical use. And Angel Raich was a woman who simply could not live without it. When you look at the symptoms she had and what happened to her when she did not use medical marijuana, it's just astonishing. And the court even acknowledged that she had these maladies and how difficult her life was, but the court said that there is no right to be free from excruciating pain. They actually said that. I mean, that's not a joke. That's in the book Who Killed the Constitution. Well, anyway, so in there we go into quite a bit of detail about the case and the arguments for and against, but to make a long story short, the federal government was arguing that medical marijuana was subject to federal regulation because its use affected interstate commerce. It affected the interstate marijuana market, which, by the way, was a market the government had made illegal. The whole thing is just crazy. And they had all these arguments as to why, if you use medical marijuana, you are actually affecting interstate commerce. I mean, it's no more sane than the Wickard versus Filburn case that I just described to you. It's worth noting, by the way, that so-called liberals on the court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, argued against Angel Raich because supposedly it's left liberals who care about individual liberties. We're supposed to believe that at least maybe they're not good on economics, but they're good on individual liberties. No, what they want more than anything else is federal supremacy. Anything else, Angel Raich's suffering, all that stuff that you'd think left liberals would care about, that gets chucked out the window. Because federal supremacy is the most important thing. So it was Ginsburg and Breyer who ruled against Angel Raich, and the fuddy-duddy right-wingers, you know, who are buzzkills when it comes to marijuana, are the ones who voted in favor of her. You know, isn't it funny how life is not as comic bookish as the media would make us think? So anyway, Clarence Thomas said this in his dissent. He says that the two patients around whom the case revolved had used, and these are his words, marijuana that has never been bought or sold, that has never crossed state lines, and that has had no demonstrable effect on the national market for marijuana. If Congress can regulate this under the Commerce Clause, then it can regulate virtually anything, and the federal government is no longer one of limited and enumerated powers. By holding that Congress may regulate activity that is neither interstate nor commerce, under the Interstate Commerce Clause, the court abandons any attempt to enforce the Constitution's limits on federal power. That's good stuff. All right, before we get to the necessary and proper clause, which will be the third and final clause of today, I want you to do yourself a favor. You're sort of doing me a favor, but you're mainly doing yourself a favor. For those of you with a traditional 9-to-5 job, think about who gets the pink slip first. Is it the person who is constantly surprising management with new skills and curiosity and ability to solve problems? Or is it the drone who never learns anything new? Well, there's an easy way to pick up new relevant skills pretty much at the drop of a hat, And that, of course, is Skillshare, with over 28,000 classes in technology, business, illustration, design, photo and film, entrepreneurship, writing, so many courses on so many topics. Well, the amazing thing is one membership gets you access to all 28,000 classes. Even more amazing, you get 2 months for free because you're a Tom Woods Show listener. You can join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare when you go to Skillshare.com/WoodsFree and you get your 2 months for free. Do that right now. Skillshare.com/WoodsFree gets you 2 free months of access to the 28,000 classes at Skillshare. You have absolutely nothing to lose here. You might as well do this. And you're going to be thanking me. Skillshare.com/WoodsFree. All right, finally, let's talk about the necessary and proper clause. This is the one your social studies teacher told you was an elastic clause that permits the federal government to exercise a broad array of powers that you won't find mentioned in the Constitution. This clause, I've read each one so far. Let me read this one to you. It declares that the Congress shall have the power to, quote, make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers, and all other powers vested by the Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. Well, first of all, we can know right away that this clause is not designed to be an elastic clause, because just about everyone would have viewed such a thing as an invitation to tyranny. It was intended as a note of clarification. It did not mean the federal government is hereby granted an array of unspecified powers. That would go against the whole structure of the Constitution, as we've seen. It meant that the government could perform simple tasks that were clearly incidental to carrying out its enumerated powers. So if you give the federal government, to use an example I used earlier, the power to erect needful buildings, well, this would by direct, rather than fanciful, interpretation, involve a power to purchase lumber for this purpose. And we get assurances like this all over the place. So in Virginia, George Nicholas says that this is it was no augmentation of power. Madison says the clause gives no supplementary power. Archibald McLean in North Carolina says the clause gives no new power. And you can, I've got example after example of this. But even Alexander Hamilton, who you would think would want to latch onto this, even he denies that it has such a role in the Constitution. He says in Federalist 33, it may be affirmed with perfect confidence that the constitutional operation of the intended government would be precisely the same if this clause were, quote, entirely obliterated. So Raoul Berger of Harvard then concludes, in sum, the records make plain that the necessary and proper clause was merely designed to specifically authorize the employment of means to effectuate, to carry into execution, granted powers, not to augment them, and they strongly read against the doctrine of implied powers. Jefferson insisted on this interpretation in 1791. He says, necessary means necessary, not merely convenient. Governments are always going to find their oppressions convenient. St. George Tucker, who was a great judge and law professor, he wrote a tremendous book called View of the Constitution of the United States in 1803, said the same thing. U.S. Senator John Taylor said the same thing. On and on, many cases. James Madison said in 1800 that this interpretation of the clause is, quote, precisely the construction which prevailed during the discussions and ratifications of the Constitution. And he just said, he went on to say, it cannot too often be repeated that this interpretation is absolutely necessary in order for the clause to be consistent with the character of the federal government, because that federal government is, quote, possessed of particular and defined powers only and not general and indefinite powers. So there it is. I mean, there's, and as I say, if you were to read what I've written on this, you'll see there's even more evidence for this. But this should suffice to, I think, to make the case. These clauses don't mean what your teachers said they mean. This is not hard to demonstrate. And everybody at the time knew that. And that's a great argument by James Madison. If the General Welfare Clause had been intended to be so expansive, the states would have been begging for an amendment. Because that power, that clause, would have been more concerning than everything else the states were concerned about put together. It doesn't mean that stuff. But this is how the state operates. You think, well, we'll limit it. And yet the very instrument by which you limit it becomes the instrument by which it justifies its expansion. because of the ways it interprets these clauses. So general welfare, so what would be its positive meaning, would mean that when you are implementing the powers that are authorized under the Constitution, you do so with an eye to the general welfare, not to the enrichment or benefit of one particular section of the union over another. That's that. General welfare, not particular welfare. So as I say, I'm going to link to a couple of books of mine where I talk about this at tomwoods.com/1421. All right, now even though that basically is our episode, I don't want to say I forbid you to turn off your device, but I just strongly urge you not to, because I want you to know about an interesting new Chrome extension that a fellow listener of this podcast has developed. The idea of it is it shifts the location of comments on blogs and wherever online from their general spot at the bottom of an article to disseminated throughout the article, like Google Docs. So instead of having a comment area in one dedicated page on the site, comments and highlights can be left and responded to by other visitors sporadically throughout the article, so that a certain sentence or paragraph would have a notification that someone left a comment about that selected content. And then you can toggle the visibility on and off so it's less distracting if you're not interested in the comments as you read through. A good way to think about the nature of inline commenting slash highlighting would be, again, to think of it as being like Google Docs for editing or making suggestions on other people's work. And it can pinpoint more precisely the comments you're trying to make. It's a really, really neat extension. And it's called Remarkenable, Remarkenable, remarkenable.com. And you can pick it up at remarkenable.com/install, remarkenable.com/install. I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com/1421. I think it's very worthwhile. And of course, the folks who developed it, what do you think they did? They got their web hosting through me so they could get some nice publicity. And that makes me happy, them happy, you happy, we're all happy. So you can get nice publicity like that. So before you go out and get your hosting, make sure and check out all the goodies that I have to offer you and how you get them. And you can check them out at tomwoods.com/publicity. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.